Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States. Episode 5.13, The Great Compromise. The middle of June 1787 brought with it the most tense time for the Constitutional Convention. Although the majority of the delegates at the convention were indeed nationalists, those interested in a strong central government, not everybody agreed on how said nationalism should be implemented. Now, before we go any further, it occurs to me that I should take just a minute and define the term nationalist. Today, nationalist is a term that often brings very specific political connotations. The nationalism that we are talking about here in 1787 is not the same kind of nationalism that would become so powerful towards the end of the 19th century, and then especially going into the 20th century. Rather, here the nationalists were simply that group that were favoring a stronger central government that existed under the Articles of Confederation. As we all know by this point, the question that had everybody jammed up was over if there should be proportional representation in the legislature, or if it should remain as one vote per state. The big states were fans of proportional, whereas the small states fought to maintain the status quo. This week, I want to stick to the story of exactly how this problem was resolved, through what will become known as the Connecticut Plan, or often the Great Compromise. Now, as we are going to see, nothing about this compromise is actually all that new or innovative. It was indeed the exact same thing that had been tossed around for weeks. However, we need to discuss how everybody finally got on board with it. We have talked about the often chaotic nature of the convention. At times, discussions would go off on haphazard tangents, as the delegates tended to skip around a bit. And by a bit, I mean a lot. Because the story of this compromise is so important and really was the prerequisite for a deal to be reached, I'm going to focus exclusively on it during the first part of our episode today. Be aware that other discussions continued to go on during this time, but skipping around like the delegates will do little but add confusion to our narrative. Before we jump into the drama that would envelop the second half of June and the first half of July, I wanted to clarify a point that I don't think I properly hit on last time. We had talked during our last episode about how the big states had won the point on proportional representation. It was going to be a thing. Right up until the New Jersey Plan was introduced and threw everything into chaos. Now, if you're asking, hey, Alan, isn't this issue settled? Why are we still talking about it? Well, I don't blame you. You see, there was nothing in the rules that were decided upon back at the beginning of the convention that said an issue that had been voted on couldn't be brought back up. So long as somebody made the motion and somebody had given it the second, then it was possible and indeed relatively common to revisit those issues that had already been voted upon. So sure enough, despite the vote in favor of proportional representation, the small states were in no mood to lay their objections aside. The New Jersey Plan, presented by William Paterson, sought to not only maintain the smaller states' power under the one state, one vote system, but actually was meant to increase their power. Realistically, the New Jersey Plan never had a great chance of passing, but that was never the point. The point was that it did a very good job of loudly proclaiming to the delegates that they had yet to settle the issue of how representation in the Congress was going to work. The common story of the Constitutional Convention is that of a meeting that, on the verge of completely falling apart and disbanding, was saved by a brilliant plan from the Connecticut delegates. This plan, which would become known by its nickname, the Great Compromise, would show that the states could work together in harmony and would indeed save the Union from dissolution and certain disaster. It is a fun story, but as we already know, there is nothing about the proposed Connecticut Plan, presented by Roger Sherman, that was all that revolutionary. If there was going to be a bicameral legislature, it made sense to pretty much everybody that the logical compromise was going to be one house, specifically the lower chamber, being proportionally represented, with the upper house representing the states with equal voting power between all of the states. Shortly after the New Jersey plan was presented, John Dickinson pulled James Madison aside and reprimanded him for pushing things too far and reminded him that if there were to be two branches of Congress, well, the solution was pretty on the nose. Madison, of course, was not a stupid guy. He fully understood what the compromise was. It did not take a great political theorist to figure that much out. This therefore leads us to the question that we are going to set out to answer today. If the obvious solution had been staring everybody in the face for weeks, then what was it that changed that finally got everybody on board? With the big states having seemingly succeeded in getting their way and securing proportional representation in both chambers, why did they find it necessary to now compromise? The New Jersey plan presented a real threat to Madison and his Virginia plan. As Madison biographer Noah Feldman states, the Virginia plan was national. The New Jersey plan was federal. In other words, if the Virginia plan meant to create a supreme national government, the New Jersey plan would have kept the states as the supreme sovereign, thus maintaining the most basic structures of the Confederation. The plan would borrow some of the aspects from the convention that seemed logical. Things like negotiating treaties was something that probably should remain with the central government. However, the New Jersey plan always represented a reform of the Articles, rather than a wholesale replacement. James Madison and his coalition had worked very hard to ensure that the Virginia plan formed the basis of the new government. He had zero interest in allowing William Patterson and his New Jersey colleagues to come in and wreck the good thing that they had been building. The New Jersey plan had forced Madison and his cadre of nationalists to shift to the defensive for the first time in the convention. During the first 3 weeks of the convention, it had been, more or less, taken for granted by Madison that the Virginia plan was going to form the broad outline of the new government. With the New Jersey plan threatening that position, Madison and company launched into a defense over its merits, and, more often, a wholesale denunciation of Patterson and his alliance of small states. John Lansing of New York, and the current bane of Alexander Hamilton's existence, argued that Madison was way out of line with his plan anyway, and that it far exceeded the mandate presented by Congress. He argued that all of this discussion over Madison's plan was an exercise in futility, because there simply was not a situation in which the states would ratify the Constitution. Madison was operating without any legitimate mandate, and that was that. Madison argued back that the decision to ratify or reject the Constitution was irrelevant to them, because it was something out of their hands, and that instead, they needed to worry about producing the best product possible. He further argued that he felt confident that the elites were going to flock to the new system and that in turn, the majority of the people would follow. Madison shows here again that he firmly believed in the power of class structure and the power of the elites of the United States. It is difficult here not to see parallels of Madison's earlier argument regarding the smaller states just falling in line with the bigger ones. Patterson at this point would launch his own attack against Madison, pointing out that if proportional voting was so great, why then did they need the convention to vote equally by state? Now, although Madison probably would not have objected to representation in the convention being based proportional to the population, he also understood that these attacks were putting all his carefully laid plans in serious danger. James Wilson countered back, arguing that he didn't understand why any of them were talking about ratification, when none of them had that power. That belonged to the people, and if they wanted to reject the plan, well, that was their prerogative. Despite all of this bickering, it was never exactly a surprise where everybody was heading. Charles Pinckney bluntly stated what everybody already knew to be true, that all of this was posturing by Patterson, and indeed the New Jersey plan as a whole, existed solely to force Madison and the big states to cave in and agree to a compromise with a proportional House and an equal Senate. The squabbling quickly turned into a stalemate. Sure, everybody probably had a hunch of how the situation was going to play out, but before it could, everybody was going to need to go through the motions and entrench further. Sherman's plan was now out there as the low-hanging fruit. Yet at the end of June, neither side was ready just yet to grab it and begin the process of moving towards a compromise. On June 27th, the New Jersey plan was pretty much put out of its misery when Luther Martin of Maryland went on a long, monotone speech that lasted into a second day. Although Martin, who was born and educated in New Jersey, made his points about the government being one of states and not, as Madison and his followers believed, of the people. The problem is that in the ranking of all-time great orators, well, suffice it to say that Martin was not exactly the second coming of Cicero. The speech was absurdly dull. It basically took all of the wind out of the sails of the small state coalition. Following a few speeches by the big state nationalists, on June 29th, a vote was held to determine if the lower house would be proportionally elected. The final vote saw four states opposed to proportional voting, six states in favor of it, with Maryland splitting their vote. Just like that, proportional voting in the House took the day. Sensing the real danger of this moment, Oliver Ellsworth quickly jumped up and reminded everybody that, before they blow this entire thing up, the Connecticut Compromise was still a thing. Ellsworth argued that the answer was that the United States was not to be an expressly federal nor national system. Rather, it was a mixture of both. A government that was a national system of the people and, at the same time, a federal system of the states. He expressed that he was okay with proportional voting in the assembly, carrying the day, despite Connecticut voting against it, in the hopes that now everybody could finally start moving towards that compromise. Although it was a respectable effort by Ellsworth, the big states also sensed blood in the water and wanted to go all in for the kill, and remained, frustratingly, unwilling to compromise. Now, banging their heads against a wall, the small states mentioned that they should send a letter to New Hampshire to, you know, just encourage them to get to Philadelphia before they missed all of the fun. The big states, seeing right through this attempt to recruit an otherwise absent small state, were able to defeat the motion. With tensions now running very high, Ellsworth found himself trading shots with James Madison, who quipped about Connecticut not paying their share of the bill for the Revolution. Ellsworth retorted that more men from Connecticut took arms than from Madison's Virginia, so he was not really in the mood to be lectured about the cost of the war. Franklin tried to soothe tempers by telling one of his classic aphorisms. However, in this instance, absolutely nobody was interested. Ahead of a vote over the nature of representation in the Senate on July 2nd, things would become even more convoluted. A small handful of delegates would find themselves being pulled away from the convention to attend to other business. These departures were not out of protest, but rather because of pragmatic considerations. You see, just because the Confederation was in its death throes did not mean that it was dead yet. During the summer of 1787, it still very much remained the operational government for the United States. Back in Congress, all of those headaches that had existed prior to the convention continued to exist. Making matters even more complicated is that several of the delegates in Philadelphia were also their state delegates to the Congress, and were forced to split their duties between the two bodies. Three such delegates splitting their duties were William Few and William Pierce of Georgia, and William Blunt of North Carolina. As the convention was risking becoming completely derailed, these three men spied an opportunity. Up in New York, where the Congress was meeting, absenteeism continued to run rampant. When our three delegates learned that a whole lot of Northern congressmen were absent, it presented them with an opportunity to pass some highly regional legislation that the Northern states would have absolutely blocked. With that, they took off their Constitution hats, hightailed it north to New York, and dove into the project of passing as much legislation as they could before the Northern Congressmen returned and ground everything to a standstill once again. This brings us to the weird case of Georgia. There is no debate that Georgia was a small state in 1787. Georgia originally had 4 delegates, however, with 2 of them leaving, that left the state's delegation down to just a pair of men, William Houston and Abraham Baldwin. The problem for the southernmost state is that Houston and Baldwin had very different takes on events. Georgia was the only state to share a border with the Spanish. As the entire situation over the Mississippi threatened to boil over into a potential conflict with Spain, it was a shared border that was making the population of Georgia mighty nervous. Even without the Spanish threat, Georgia faced a significant amount of danger from the Western tribes. Recall that back during the First Continental Congress, Georgia failed to send a delegation, largely because they very much wanted all the British assistance that they could get to help protect their eastern borders. Now, Baldwin was absolutely a nationalist. He supported a strong central government that would help protect his state's vulnerable borders. Baldwin also worried about the larger northern states using their power and influence to end slavery, something that would, although making the now late John Oglethorpe happy, be devastating to the local economy. With these considerations in mind, Baldwin fell in and voted with the small states. Houston, on the other hand, believed that the price of securing Georgia was allying themselves with the larger states, and thus voting with the likes of Virginia. Sure, a loss of sovereignty isn't ideal, but at least Virginia would offer them protection from the many significant dangers that the state faced. Just like that, when the vote came on July 2nd, Georgia effectively nullified itself. When the vote came for proportional voting in the Senate, the state split 5-5. Delaware, Connecticut, New Jersey, Maryland, and New York all voted against proportional voting. Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and both North and South Carolina voted in favor of proportional representation. Georgia split and therefore was nullified. The New Hampshire delegation was still not present, and Rhode Island continued to stick their fingers in their ears and pretend that none of this was actually happening. A tie was just about the most fraught outcome possible. Although the small states had not explicitly won anything, this was sufficient enough for men like Madison to finally begin to understand how much danger all of his plans were really in. If ignoring the smaller states had previously seemed like the easiest path forward towards pushing through his Virginia plan, the vote on July 2nd made abundantly clear to everybody that the small states were not simply going to fade away into the background. Although Madison would continue to object, by now it had become apparent that some kind of compromise was going to be necessary. Following the tie on the 2nd, the mood in the convention began shifting towards sending the issue of representation to a committee. Madison was personally opposed to any such idea, as he knew very well that sending the question to a committee was going to lead to a predictable compromise. Oliver Ellsworth, not missing a beat, suggested that each state name a delegate to a committee that would put the issue to rest and come up with a compromise. Of course, what Ellsworth really meant is that they would take the Connecticut plan and adopt the system that had been bandied about for weeks. Ellsworth himself had frequently suggested the Connecticut plan as a logical compromise between the two sides. On this point, Ellsworth won out. The question over the makeup of the legislature was heading to a committee. One delegate from each state would be chosen, and together they would hammer out a compromise and break the logjam. Ellsworth himself came down with a cough-cough cold right before the committee was to meet, clearing the way for Roger Sherman to join the committee. Other members would include William Patterson of New Jersey Plan fame, George Mason, Elbridge Gerry, and, of course, Benjamin Franklin. Even now, with the issue before a committee, the convention remained in danger as the small states made clear that they were getting ready to pack it up and call it a day if this vote did not go their way. For a week between July 4th and July 10th, there was real worry that the small states were indeed going to bow out. Luther Martin wrote during this week that the convention was being held together by the strength of a hair. On July 10th, two delegates, Robert Yates and John Lansing of New York, left the convention in protest with no plans to return. Now, as a quick reminder, although the convention was primarily made up of men with nationalist leanings, even if they did not all exactly agree on what that meant, Lansing and Yates were very much sent to the convention to stand staunchly on the anti-nationalist side of the ledger. They never really found much of a footing in this regard, and therefore had little role in doing much of anything at the convention. Their departure also briefly meant that New York did not have any delegation at the convention, as Hamilton had temporarily returned to New York. On July 16th, the suspense finally came to an end when it was announced that a compromise had been reached. Surprise, surprise. The compromise saw the House retaining its proportional representation, with the Senate being represented equally amongst the states. In other words, it was the exact compromise that everybody in the room was well aware it was going to be. When the vote came, the Mid-Atlantic states voted in a block. Connecticut, New Jersey, Delaware, and Maryland were always going to be an emphatic vote in favor of equal representation in the Senate. North Carolina likewise flipped its vote and sided with the small states. There was little surprise when Virginia and Pennsylvania voted against the proposed compromise. South Carolina and Georgia sided with Virginia. Georgia, as discussed earlier, was desperate for a strong national government to help defend them against the very real threats that they were now facing along their western and southern borders. Okay, so now we have 5 votes for equal representation and 4 against. Rhode Island was busy ignoring the convention altogether. The New Hampshire delegates were looking for spare change under the couch cushions to cover their expenses. The New York delegation had stormed off in protest or, in the case of Hamilton, was rendered essentially powerless and thus returned to his own personal business in New York. Massachusetts, undeniably one of the largest states, could have voted with its big state brethren. However, as it turned out, Elbridge Gerry liked the compromise that the committee he was on helped to draft, causing him to vote in favor of equal representation. The other Massachusetts delegate, Rufus King, stood opposed. Thus, Massachusetts split its vote and was nullified. Just like that, after weeks of bickering and fighting, equal representation had just won the day by a vote of 5-4. Now it was time for the big states to mope. When Edmund Randolph asked for the session to adjourn for the day, many confused his question, thinking that he was asking for the convention to be adjourned permanently. Madison himself was obviously distraught over the outcome of the compromise. He had always expected that the small states would just bend to the will of the big states. And, well, it just did not work out that way. Just to kick James Madison while he is down, it is worth noting that his other brainchild, the National Negative, would be officially defeated the very next day. The Great Compromise and the loss of his National Negative would leave the man whom is so often considered the father of the Constitution deeply disappointed in the end result. However, disappointed or not, the job of framing the government was not yet over. There were still issues at hand that had to be hammered out. We are going to spend the remainder of today, and then some of our time in our next episode, looking at just how the delegates would resolve the other pressing issues that were present. However, suffice it to say that once the compromise was struck, as a whole, everything fell into place much easier. The question over representation in the legislature was the biggest single hurdle facing the delegates. And once it was removed, everybody found it far easier to come to grips with the remainder of the document. Madison at this point would largely turn his efforts towards the question of the separation of powers. For instance, he argued against the legislature having the power to appoint the executive. What Madison was worried about at this point is that if the legislature controlled the appointment of the executive, it would create a legislature that was essentially all-powerful. especially since the appointment of judges to the judiciary would flow through the executive branch. Therefore, if the legislature controlled the appointment of the executive, they would, in effect, also control the entire judicial branch. As to this specific issue, Madison would advocate that judges should be selected by the executive, subject to approval by the Senate, which is the system that persists to this day. The executive, he argued, should be chosen directly by the people. Madison, more than just being far-reaching here, was very aware of the political ramifications that he was dealing with. Like it or not, the United States was going to be a country riddled with regional differences. When considering offices such as the executive or judges on the Supreme Court, now that the Senate had equal voting, there was a real risk of a powerful Senate giving too much power to these different regional demands. The specific thing that Madison worried about was the large number of New England states, as compared to the relatively few Southern states. Under this proposed system, the New England region would dominate in the Senate. That this battle began almost immediately after the Great Compromise indicated that Madison was now pivoting to trying to reduce the effective power of the Senate. This brings us around to the question of exactly why the United States uses the Electoral College. For those of you outside of the United States who may be listening, the country uses a system whereby the people do not exactly vote for the president, but rather vote for the election of a slate of electors that are pledged to vote for a specific person to be the president. It is an incredibly roundabout, poorly understood system, which every so often will throw the entire country into a tizzy when the president is elected despite losing the popular vote. With James Madison doing what he could to limit the power of the legislature, he argued that any executive elected directly by the legislature would be subservient to the views of the groups that elected them. This means that the president would become an extremely partisan office that would be subjected to all kinds of political winds inside the legislature. Madison further argued that if the entire point of the executive was to act as a check on Congress, well, then it didn't make much sense in that case to have an executive exist at the whims of the legislature that it was meant to be checking. Likewise, as to the option of having the state legislatures pick the executive, Madison was firmly opposed as well. James Madison had spent the entire convention trying to limit the power of the states, so the very last thing that he wanted to do in July 1787 was to hand power right back to them. By Madison's own logic here, if the executive should be divorced from the legislature, and if the transfer of power from state legislatures to the national government was the point of this entire ordeal in the first place, that left him with only a single option: the people, be it via direct election or through electors. This was, unsurprisingly, not met with universal acceptance. Now, by this point, I imagine that you have all picked up on the fact that the founders were not exactly trustworthy of the people. After all, the new national government was set to shift power from the local state level to the national level. Some, such as Aldrich Gary, worried that an executive who was popularly elected would give huge amounts of power to organizations that could exert influence at a national level. In other words, if there was some group out there that had an objective that they wished to accomplish, if they were sufficiently powerful throughout the entire country, they could potentially influence and manipulate the people into voting a specific way. Gary did not enter into this argument without having his examples ready to go, and specifically named the Society of the Cincinnati as being the exact type of organization that had that kind of power and reach. Others, like Charles Pinckney and Roger Sherman, argued that the average person really had no hope of successfully judging the person running for office. George Mason went so far as to say that asking the people to judge the character of a chief executive was akin to asking a blind man to judge his favorite color. Elitist arguments aside, there certainly were a good number of delegates who felt the exact same way. Now, on the other side of the bill, you had Luther Martin and Gouverneur Morris coming out in defense of the people. Morris argued that he disagreed with the concerns of men like Sherman and Mason and fully believed that the people had the ability to select the chief executive for themselves. It was here that Luther Martin would take the first shot at establishing elections via electors, a motion that was voted down initially. Although everybody understood the basic need to have the executive act as a check upon the legislature, that did not mean that there did not remain a strong contingent that believed that there were other ways to combat this problem. There were at least some who felt that there were two ways to go here, that would both allow the legislature to choose the chief executive while maintaining the executive check on that same legislative branch. One potential method was a plan that would limit the executive to a single 7-year term. Once the executive was chosen, the legislature would have little other reason for direct interaction. The second possibility was that the executive serve in good behavior, which is code for lifetime tenure. Here, the argument became that too short a time as the executive would represent a waste of talent, and there was expected to be a very steep learning curve. When it came to lifetime appointments, well, unsurprisingly, that reeked a little bit too much of monarchy to be a widely supported plan. Madison would ultimately go on to support a plan that called for the direct election of the president. Not that he necessarily liked the plan. Madison was no populist and had his misgivings about the average person. He also understood that direct elections came with problems of its own, specifically giving the North an advantage in the vote, as more of the population there would be able to meet the requirements in order to vote. Keep in mind that nobody here was arguing for something as radical as, say, universal suffrage. There was always going to be limits on exactly who would have the right to vote for the executive. George Mason continued to advocate against popular election, now turning to the practical difficulties. The United States was a really big place. It was going to be impossible for a potential chief executive to have enough of a national reputation that people could truly make an informed decision. Moving through the United States in the 18th century was nowhere near as easy as it is today. Mason smartly pointed out that the beginning of the convention itself had been delayed more than a week as everybody slowly wandered into Philadelphia, a direct result of those bad roads and poor infrastructure. Now, to be clear, everybody was pretty well aware that George Washington existed, and that he would almost certainly be the first chief executive if they had their way. Washington was one of the very few men during the 18th century who had the kind of national reputation that would be required of a chief executive. The worry, however, was over the fact that Washington was only one man and could not serve in that capacity forever. Benjamin Franklin may have been the only other person there with potential name recognition on par with Washington, but by the time of the convention, he was in failing health and was unlikely to live long enough to ever reach so lofty a position. Indeed, he would die just 3 years after the end of the convention. The question would ultimately find itself in a committee, which would, in late July, hammer out many of the final details of what would become the executive branch. This committee, which would become known as the Committee on Postponed Matters, would reach a compromise on how the national executive was to be chosen. It was settled that each state would receive a number of electors equal to their total representation in the legislature. It was, however, left up to the states on exactly how those electors would be selected. This means that although some states might choose popular election, others were free to use their legislatures to select the electors. Once selected, the electors would meet in their own state and would vote for two people, only one of which would come from their state. Those ballots from each state were then sent along to the Senate, where so long as a majority was met, the person with the most votes became the executive and the runner-up, the vice executive. Now, if you're sitting there thinking that this is just about the most convoluted and confusing system the committee could have settled on, well, you're not wrong. Apparently, all of this was the brainchild of James Wilson and John Dickinson. They believed that, when it came to ratification, the presidency was going to prove to be the biggest hurdle. He thought that by granting the states, and thus the people, wide latitude to control the office, it would help lessen the blow of a strong central executive. Still, though, amongst many, there was a whole lot of confusion and anger as to why they were going with an electoral college in the first place. The argument in favor of the electoral college was that this method eliminated a lot of the biggest problems that came with having the national legislature responsible for picking the chief executive. You would not have to worry about overbearing term limits to prevent legislative abuse. Having the electors remain in their respective state would prevent them, by sheer distance alone, from colluding together to get their chosen man into office. Likewise, if you needed to impeach the executive, that was going to be much easier when they were not directly tied to the people who put the president in the office in the first place. Nobody would want to impeach a president who they themselves had advocated for to get that position. Electors eliminated that concern. There was pushback against this plan, to be sure. The day after the committee returned their compromise, and for timeline's sake, we are in September for this particular debate, the issue was argued again. The conclusion was that if the power to choose the executive was given to the Senate, then the executive and the Senate would dominate the House. If it was given to the proportionally represented House, it meant that the large states would dominate the small states, which was a can of worms that nobody wanted to reopen. Roger Sherman, he of great compromises, pointed out that, as was already the case, the large states held the advantage because they would receive more electors. The compromise he reached was that, in the event that there was no majority or a tie in the Electoral College, it was the House that would select the president. However, in order to get around the whole proportional representation issue, each state would vote as a bloc, meaning that, despite the House being proportional, it was going to be one vote per state. This was enough to satisfy just about everybody, and the motion carried the day. Finally, it was argued that the term of the presidency be for a period of 4 years. However, there was no prohibition put on how many terms an individual could hold the office for. I'm going to leave things here for today. With major compromises now in place for both the legislature and the executive, the new constitution was, slowly, but surely, coming together. Next time, we are going to return to a couple of the other more well-known constitutional provisions. Specifically, we need to discuss the Three-Fifths Clause and take an overall look at how slavery was playing into the entire process. Until then, I hope you all have a wonderful 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time as we look at the impact of slavery on the convention.